The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we're back with part two of our discussion of psychedelics with a special focus on psilocybin mushrooms. So in the last episode, if you haven't heard that yet, you should probably go back and listen to that one first. That's where we lay the groundwork for a lot of the stuff we're talking about today, where we ended up talking about a little bit about the history of psychedelics, about where we stand in that history, which we'll explore more over the next couple of episodes. We talked about a lot of the common features of the psychedelic experience and what those reported features have in common with, say, what William James described as the mystical experience or the religious experience. So we talked about like the ideas of the psychedelic experience being ineffable or hard to put into words, often having this quality of veridicality or the noetic quality, seeming like it isn't just an experience, but that it somehow imparts true information to you.
Right. And then we also just talked about, in general terms, like, what is a drug? What does this term drug mean? And why do we apply it to some substances that have a physiological effect on us and not to others?
Right.
And then what indeed is a psychedelic? And again, all those properties that we typically associate with the psychedelic experience.
Right. And one of the funny things is, when I was growing up, I thought of drugs as one class of things that are all equally bad and, you know, all equally scary. And, of course, this was, you know, United States drug policy conditioning as it filtered through into the education system. And in a way, you can kind of understand, like, you know, you want kids to be aware of the dangers of messing with addictive substances. You don't want kids trying out, you know, heroin or cocaine or even tobacco, really, you know.
As a father, I totally get that.
Yeah. But then all these other things get lumped in with that stuff.
Right. And yeah, I mean, we could certainly, a lot has been said, a lot has been written, and we could probably spend a whole time just dissecting the war on drugs and what didn't work, and just sort of some of the problematic aspects of the messaging. Because I remember growing up and going to these, like, the DARE rallies at school. This was a U.S. educational outreach program to keep kids off of drugs. And there was this, it did feel like drugs were just the enemy, and then anything else you might be taking, like, there was medication. Drugs certainly wasn't something that would, a term that would be used to describe Tylenol or anything. But yeah, in doing this, you end up like just vilifying all of these substances, and also perhaps making them more appealing in a certain sense, you know, because mm-hmm. you're telling all these kids, no, this is dark, dangerous stuff. Don't get near the dark magic of drugs. And at the same time, it can lead to this false impression that drugs were a product of the 1960s, or least of the mid 20th century, that we had like a time before drugs, and then suddenly here comes the psychedelic counterculture. Here comes the marijuana. Marijuana, of course, came in earlier. Same can be said of cocaine and opium and so forth. But still, you could easily get this false idea in your head that these were products of modern society. They were new modern problems, and certainly there are versions of these substances that were modern, and problems that they introduced were thoroughly modern. Mm-hmm. For instance, things like when you start talking about like crack cocaine, or you start talking about heroin, those are the more modern twists on very old organisms, you know, going back to the poppy seed or the coca plant.
Yeah, and even referring to the more psychedelic substances, not say like opium-based alkaloids or something like that, but, psilocybin and LSD. LSD was, in a way, kind of invented. It is a compound that was isolated from the ergot in 1938, I think it was. And mm-hmm. then first, you know, Albert Hofmann figured out what it was in the 1940s. So that was kind of new. But psychedelics in general were not new. It's certainly been around. They've been used by humans for hundreds or thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about organisms. We're talking about species that evolved to thrive in our world. And take psilocybin, for instance. Again, it's found in some 200 different varieties of 200 different species of mushrooms. And exactly why they have these properties is still something that scientists are looking into. But according to a 2018 study from Ohio State University, the psychedelic properties of psilocybin-containing mushrooms may have evolved as an appetite suppressant to deter insects that frequented the animal dung from which the mushrooms grew, which is interesting. Because that's not even a quality of a psychedelic experience that we even touched on in the previous episode. But there is an appetite suppressant that is taking place as well.
So maybe a lot of the classic effects that we identify as psychedelic are merely byproducts of the compounds that the primary evolutionary purpose of which is an appetite suppressant. Though that's just a hypothesis, right?
Yeah, a hypothesis. It's still an open question. But there's no such thing as LSD munchies.
Right. I mean, there are, funny enough, there are much weirder hypotheses. I mean, much weirder ones. In the last episode, we talked about the people with the sort of mycocentric worldview who mm-hmm. come to see, like Terrence McKenna and the people who come to see mushrooms as in some way kind of secretly running the world. And some of these people, you know, they'll get into ideas of how, well, really the reason that psilocybin exists, you know, this compound has these effects on us, is that it evolved as some kind of communication mechanism mm-hmm. where the fungus world is trying to break through to us because we're the like dominant moving species that controls energy and ecosystems. And it's trying to get through to us and open our minds to its priorities.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, you know, certainly we're not going to get into the question of whether psilocybin-containing mushrooms are gods.
Or whether they're conscious.
But,
well, actually, no, I think maybe Eduardo Cohn might have something to say about that. But
he does. And we'll touch on that a little later. But I don't want to associate him too much with this. With the sort of more extreme version of this. But in terms of just associating psilocybin and psychedelics with gods, there's nothing new about that, and we'll get into that as we go here. One of the connections that McKenna makes in his stoned ape hypothesis is that since you have psilocybin growing out of the dung of herbivores, namely cattle, mm-hmm. This would have been something that would have become obvious to peoples that were rearing cattle in the ancient world.
Right.
And then it would have traveled with them as they brought their cattle with them. And he makes a case I'm not sure exactly how strong it is, for the various cattle gods of antiquity, you know, the sort of, you know, horned gods.
The golden calf.
Yeah, that part of their association is with the psilocybin mushrooms that would have been almost like the milk of the animal. Like the animal produces meat, the animal produces milk, the animal produces this substance that allows us to engage in a mystic experience.
That's an interesting potential ecological relationship. I mean, the same way that zoonotic diseases follow human civilization where they've got domesticated animals, right? Because they're in close proximity to certain domesticated animals. The diseases that affect those animals have a greater likelihood of jumping over into, you know, into the human strains.
Right.
But you could say the same thing about things that are not diseases, but other follow-on organisms, for example, psilocybin mushrooms.
Right, right. Yeah. Now, to be clear, I think, you know, as we've discussed in the show before, I think it's always too tempting to try and point to a single thing as being like the prime motivator in the creation of mythologies and the genesis of gods. And
right.
So, you know, I'm open to the idea that psilocybin could have played a role in the character of some of these gods. And we do see specific gods, as we'll discuss, that have clear iconography associated with psychedelic substances.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, there are so many other processes going on in the generation of divine entities in the human mind.
Well, one interesting question, at least interesting to me, is the question of why did we start taking these substances?
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the use of psilocybin goes way back into history, and we'll talk sort of about the natural and cultural history of psilocybin, especially in a bit. But like, why? What benefit biologically would there have been to doing this? I mean, is it something that humans do just as a sort of like byproduct of the way their brains work and there is no real biological benefit? Or is there a biological benefit that maybe we don't fully recognize? Is there an adaptive reason to take psychedelic drugs?
Yeah, because a lot of times we think of these substances as being, especially in the Western context, you know, purely recreational, purely even hedonistic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we're seeing out of the especially the more recent studies and even the studies of the 1950s and 60s. And it's also not what we see in traditional societies that use them.
Right.
There was an attempt, you know, these were used very seriously as a means of solving problems and communing with the mystical world, et cetera.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you can, I mean, one thing that automatically sticks out there for me is that if there is some kind of adaptive value to these things, it could have some kind of, you know, social reinforcement role, right? You know, this is a common kind of thing. You say, what is the value of X cultural practice? Very often you could say, well, maybe it strengthens social bonds in some way, you know, helps groups work together better, helps them share information and bond better so that they're more effective as a hunting team or something like that.
Right.
So that's a possibility, but we don't know that's the case. But another way of thinking about it is, could we better understand the uses of psychedelics in humans and the reasons for those uses by looking at the effects of psychedelics in other animals? So for one thing, there are some people in the world that actually give psychedelic drugs to domestic animals for ritual and practical purposes. And there's one example I came across that I thought was a really interesting study. This is a study by Bradley Bennett and Rocio Alarcón, called Hunting and Hallucinogens, the Use of Psychoactive and Other Plants to Improve the Hunting Ability of Dogs.
So this is giving psychedelic substances to animals with a purpose that's not research-related, but also not purely recreational, like some of these videos you see of, say, squirrels allegedly consuming psychedelic mushrooms.
Right, yeah. So this would be something parallel to an adaptive value in a hunting scenario. And so this paper was in the Journal of Ethnopharmacology in 2015. So the authors here looked at the use of psychoactive substances by two tribes in South America, the Shuar and the Quichua of Ecuador, who are reported to give hallucinogenic plants to their hunting dogs in order to improve their hunting ability. And the authors find that this practice is prevalent and they think it's likely adaptive. Now, what good would it do to give a hunting dog a hallucinogen, right? It would seem to me, if you didn't think too deeply about it, that just seems counterproductive, right? It's going to make the dog distracted, probably less effective.
Right, yeah. The idea is that it would alter its perception of reality, but doesn't it need a fine-tuned perception of reality in order to do its hunting?
Exactly. But the authors, quote, hypothesize that hallucinogenic plants alter perception in hunting dogs by diminishing extraneous signals and by enhancing sensory perception, most likely olfaction, or the sense of smell, that is directly involved in the detection and capture of game.
Now, this is interesting because we always have to recognize that a dog is a far more smell-based creature than we can really almost more. It's more smell-based than we can imagine.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're such a visual species. Mm-hmm. And certainly psychedelics are going to alter the sense of smell. We discussed that briefly last time. Like, you smells may change. Smells may seem strange.
Uh-huh.
And imagine that in a creature for whom smell is this really rich means of sensing the external world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in the same way that a psychedelic experience is often ineffable, there's this quality to it that you can't describe once it's over and communicate to other people. I think probably the sense experience of other kinds of animals, animals like dogs, is probably ineffable and ununderstandable from our point of view. Like, there's no way for you to picture or put yourself into the level of chemosensitivity of a dog, their level of engagement with all of the chemical signals going on around them that we only get this tiny, blunt, faint kind of whiff of.
Yeah.
So that's obviously an important part of their hunting perception. But of course, they have other senses too. They've got hearing and smell and all that. So maybe what's going on, again, we don't know this. This is just what the authors hypothesize. You know, in the last episode, we talked about how one of the common reported effects of taking psilocybin as a hallucinogen is the experience of heightened perceptions. Like, you know, colors might seem more vivid or brighter, or you might feel like you have a more acute sense of hearing. It's hard for me to imagine that, like, you actually have greater resolution in your eyeballs for sight, but there might be something going on in the brain where suddenly more power is devoted to noticing detail in what you see or something like that. And so you can imagine maybe the same is true in these hunting dogs. Maybe, you know, brain power gets sort of reorganized in a way where there's new levels of attention to detail and smell that would normally be dedicated to other senses or other distracting mental processes. But then again, we don't know that's the case. That's just an interesting possibility for what's going on here if this is in fact adaptive, which the authors think it probably is. The authors also write, this is funny, quote, if this is true, plant substances might also enhance the ability of dogs to detect explosive, drugs, human remains, and other targets for which they are valued.
Oh,
so, so the drug dogs will now be given.
Will be given drugs, yeah. Yeah, this is interesting. A possible future in which, say, explosive-sniffing dogs will be microdosing.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps macro dosing in order to find what they're looking for. We do want to stress that we are not encouraging anyone out there to take a psychedelic substance and attempt to carry out any particular tasks in their life.
No, we're also not encouraging people to dose their pets or domestic animals with substances you might not know the effects of. I mean, that's just not advisable.
But this does remind me. So of course, microdosing is this what supposed trend in like Silicon Valley and
right.
so forth,
yeah, where you take a little bit of LSD,
a little bit of some sort of psychedelic in order to give you some supposed slight edge on whatever your coding job happens to be, et cetera. And I don't know. I haven't looked at the research on that to see if there is any research on that to say exactly how that holds up.
Mm-hmm.
But it does.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It does remind me of a recent Saturday Night Live sketch in which there's a film reviewer who appears on Weekend Update who, instead of microdosing to go review films, is macrodosing. So he's taking like a colossal amount of psychedelics and then going and seeing just whatever the Hollywood films of the day happen to be, and then having these just crazy reviews of them. I recommend everybody check that out.
I haven't seen that one.
Now, I think something that's interesting about this hunting dog study, though, is that it kind of like roughly falls in line with some of the arguments that McKenna made back in 93 in Food of the Gods for psilocybin aiding humanity's ancestors along three different levels.
Uh-huh.
So, but one of the key areas is he was pointing to the work of psychopharmacologist Roland L. Fisher, saying, quote, small amounts of psilocybin consumed with no awareness of its psychoactivity while in the general act of browsing for food and perhaps later consumed consciously impart a noticeable increase in visual acuity, especially edge detection. As visual acuity is at a premium among hunter-gatherers, the discovery of the equivalent of, quote, chemical binoculars could not fail to have an impact on the hunting and gathering success of those individuals who availed themselves of this advantage.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and he also argues that at higher doses, restlessness and sexual arousal would have played a role. And then finally, shamanistic ecstasy would have of course, been an important part, and it clearly was an important part of the use of psychedelics for early people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that this paper really backs up McKenna in any meaningful way here, and I'm also not sure if his interpretation of Fisher's work is completely fair or if he's leaning into his assumptions on this.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, if psilocybin makes a hunting dog slightly better at hunting or a hunter-gatherer slightly better at their thing, then I think this is kind of interesting. I mean, the same case can and is made for natural substances that work as stimulants, which, of course, are widely used through human culture. And, you know, for every employee out there who's not microdosing with psilocybin, everybody else is micro or macro dosing with caffeine.
Yeah, ultra-dosing on caffeine, yeah.
Or, goodness, I remember hearing tales of like the older newsrooms where a cigarette mate was a request, where someone would be like working on a deadline and they're drinking coffee and they need somebody to actually like stick the cigarette in their mouth to give so that and light it up for them so they can have the nicotine rush to finish their job.
Or even the cliche of the use of cocaine in business and Wall Street.
Yeah, or and before that, the you know, I've heard tales of, you know, of laborers, you know, being depending on cocaine back in the day as being like a primary mean of just getting through the labor of the day. And of course, in the armed forces of the 20th and 21st centuries, you see a lot of use of stimulants.
Yeah.
Certainly, we've talked about this on the show before, the use of stimulants by the Nazis during the Second World War was pretty extensive, especially in the Luftwaffe. And today, you still see various stimulants that are designed for use on long flights in military contexts.
All right. Well, I think maybe we should take a break. And then when we come back, we will talk a little bit about animal self-administration of hallucinogens.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So before we get into the self-administration of psychedelics by animals, just a quick reminder that animals in general are known to make use of various chemicals in their environment. It may be something more internal, like a poison dart frog acquiring its toxicity via the plants that it consumes, or it could be something like lemurs that take a centipede, crush it, and spread the toxicity of the of this species on their fur, presumably to keep insects away. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of cases like that where it's either a more complex part of the creature's physiology, or it is something that they are doing almost like tool use of the toxins in their environment.
A great example of this I remember from our squirrels episodes was the ground squirrel. Mm-hmm. Some Western United States or Western North American ground squirrel has a strategy for avoiding its rattlesnake predators, which is finding discarded rattlesnake skins after the snake sheds its skin, chewing that up and rubbing it all over its body and the bodies of its young.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's brilliant.
But so these are all, you know, self-administrations of chemicals by animals. So would animals take psychedelic drugs given the opportunity? Do they just seek these things out and consume them voluntarily? It's one thing if maybe an animal consumes a hallucinogen by accident, you know, because mm-hmm. it's just there's a psychedelic compound in their environment and they happen to eat it while they're foraging, versus behaviors where it really does seem like they're actively seeking it out and after they have the experience once try to repeat it.
Have you ever seen the movie The Bear?
No, I haven't.
I forget the French director's name. He directed the original The Name of the Rose. But the bear, I remember, as being a very fun film about this bear using lots of like real bears used in the film. But there's a sequence in which the bear eats a psychedelic mushroom and has a psychedelic experience. And it's pretty wonderful. If you don't see the whole movie, I recommend everyone check out that sequence on like YouTube if it's still out there.
Well, the bear would not be alone in the animal kingdom, it turns out. So there is a paper that I want to refer to here from the International Journal of Addictions. This is from 1973. So a lot of thinking about drugs has changed since then. But this does document some like recorded animal behaviors that are pretty interesting. So this is called An Ethological Search for Self-Administration of Hallucinogens by Ronald K. Siegel. And so it's been reported previously by Wasson in 1968, who we'll learn a bit more about later in the episode, that reindeer often self-administer hallucinogenic mushrooms known as Amanita muscaria or fly agaric. And they will find these mushrooms when they're available and they will eat them. So if you've never seen what these look like, they're worth looking up. They're kind of the classic like toadstool looking mushroom, mm-hmm. you know, kind of the red and white spotted cap. And the reindeer are also known, interestingly, to try to ingest the urine of humans who have been consuming this same species of mushroom for psychedelic purposes. Wasson wrote in 1968, quote, "When human urine or mushrooms are in the vicinity, the half-domesticated beasts become unmanageable. All reindeer folk know of these two addictions. Reindeer, like men, suffer or enjoy profound mental disturbances after eating the fly agaric." So Siegel writes that the normal diet of a reindeer is almost entirely composed of lichens. And so, you know, life in the tundra can be gastronomically boring sometimes. but they do also appear to have this strong instinct toward the consumption of hallucinogenic mushrooms and the human urine containing the active metabolites of the same mushroom. So according to Siegel, the Chukchi people of the eastern Arctic Russia region, the Chukchi Peninsula, sometimes take fly agaric intentionally, which leads to, quote, elation, sedation, colored visions, and hallucinations. And the reindeer, who can acquire these compounds through raw mushrooms or human urine, quote, become just as drunk and have just as great a thirst. At night, they are noisy and keep running around the tents in the expectation of being given the longed-for fluid. And when some is spilled out in the snow, they start quarreling, tearing away from each other the clumps of snow moistened with it. And that's another quote from Wasson. One report, quote, "stresses the passion of the reindeer for human urine is so intense that it is likely to make it dangerous to relieve oneself in the open when there are reindeer around." There's also some scant evidence that reindeer who ingest these compounds subsequently isolate themselves from the herd. But again, the evidence here is not clear. And self-isolating behavior could have other causes, though this lines up with other observations that Siegel makes.
Yeah, Wasson did a lot of work regarding fly agaric. This was, an extremely ancient shamanistic intoxicant that was used by the Tunguska tribes of ancient Siberia. And he even presented it as a potential candidate for soma. Soma was this mystical substance that was consumed in Vedic India, and it's been interpreted, nobody's quite sure what exactly it was, but it's been interpreted as having been opium, cannabis, ergot, ephedra is a strong candidate that you often see discussed, and then sometimes the case is made for psilocybin as well. And it may have been different substances at different times, too. Mm. That's always important to keep in mind. McKenna, of course, makes an argument in his book for psilocybin, and he spends a lot of time with that. But soma is certainly a fascinating substance to try and unravel because it was an important Indo-European substance, again, described in the Vedas. It was also seems to be the same thing as homa, which was an important pre-Zoroastrian substance in Persia. And it was attributed with all sorts of mystical and curative properties. It was, quote, the pillar of the world.
Wow.
And some still make a case for psychedelic substances being in play here, while others are kind of strongly in the ephedra realm. So seeing it more as purely a stimulant.
Yeah, that's interesting. And honestly, I really did not know much about fly agaric before looking at this. So. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. If I recall correctly, there are even people who make interesting commentary about Santa Claus and flying reindeer.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, in relation to this.
I've read about this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the myth of the flying reindeer comes from them eating these mushrooms or eating the urine of people who have eaten the mushrooms and loosing the bonds of Earth's gravity.
Yeah.
So Siegel actually looks at a number of other recorded patterns of self-administration of psychoactive substances in animals. And another example he gives is the mongoose, which has been reported to seek out hallucinogenic toads and other prey containing potentially psychoactive compounds during hunting, even when other prey are available. To read this quote, "Some mongooses in the West Indies and the Hawaiian Islands apparently ingest Bufo marinus toads, which I should add are now known as the Rhinella marina toads, the cane toad, the scourge of Australia, which we've talked about in a recent episode about cannibalism or almost cannibalism, because apparently these toads, they like to eat their own tadpoles and juveniles. But these toads, quote, contain the hallucinogen bufotenine. And to continue, "this phenomenon is something of a mystery, since other toads as well as other natural prey are more abundant in these regions. While it is not known if there are psychoactive effects resulting from such ingestions, the mongoose goes out of its way to ingest a variety of psychoactive compounds and poisons, including the poison bulb of scorpions and the sting, which he quotes another author, which it seems to consider a bonne bouche."
That's interesting, considering that the mongoose is invasive. It was introduced to Hawaii as well as other places such as the Bahamas, Cuba, Jamaica, etc. And then the cane toad as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. The cane toad, I think, is originally native to South America primarily. Mm-hmm. And that's not it for all of the potential animal self-administrations of psychedelic compounds that have been recorded by people observing animal behavior. Just a few quick notes mentioned in a little article in the Pharmaceutical Journal in 2010 by Andrew Haynes, which has a truly horrible title that I'm not going to read, and I'm going to assume was assigned by a web editor. It mentioned something about animal junkies.
Yeah. Well, it was a different time.
Okay. So a few examples mentioned here are apparently that bighorn sheep of the Canadian Rockies apparently seek out and consume psychoactive lichen. Quote, in scraping it off the rock surface, they can wear their teeth down to the gums.
Ugh.
And in the rainforests of South America, apparently jaguars are known to sometimes gnaw on the roots and bark of the yagé plant.
This is the plant that is from which DMT is derived.
Yeah, it's the plant used in the making of ayahuasca tea. Mm-hmm. And the jaguars apparently tend to so after they gnaw on this plant, they have been recorded acting playful and kind of kittenish. And some wild animals in Africa, including boars, porcupines, and some primates like mandrills, are known to dig up and eat the hallucinogenic roots of the iboga plant.
I love the idea of a jaguar consuming this and just kind of being, it's almost like it's eating catnip or something. It's just a little playful.
Uh-huh.
When the jaguar is considered such a spiritual animal in the traditions of Amazonian people, and it's like it's the kind of spirit that you would perhaps encounter while on an ayahuasca journey.
Well, this has even been hypothesized. This is certainly not known, but it's mm-hmm. been speculated that maybe the consumption of ayahuasca as a sacred rite came from observing the jaguar doing this.
Oh.
And so the idea is that, the jaguar is this powerful spiritual beast and that its behaviors might have been copied by humans.
Yeah, this is something important we didn't mention in the first episode. We talked about humans gradually figuring out what they could eat and what they couldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, humans can also look to see what other animals are capable of eating, which is not always a definite sign that you should eat it.
Right.
There are things that animals can eat and certain species can eat that we absolutely cannot.
Yeah, they might have different enzymes and stuff that we
right.
don't.
But then again, if you see an animal completely avoiding a particular substance, that might be a clear sign that you should avoid it as well, or perhaps that the magic of cooking is necessary in order to harness it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you see some sort of peculiar behavior taking place after an animal consumes something, well, maybe more study is required.
Now, just the fact that an animal will self-administer a drug is clearly not evidence that that drug is a good thing or a healthy thing for that animal to consume.
Right. I mean we've all seen our pets consume things.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean that it's making a wise choice in its environment.
Or I think about there are lab studies where, lab mice will have the option to self-administer addictive drugs, mm-hmm. they can self-administer morphine or whatever. And sometimes this is used in studies to figure out how to break addictions, like what kinds of opportunities when offered to mice will be more attractive to mice than just trying to self-administer more doses of morphine.
Right. But then again, we're talking about morphine in a drip or something, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is not something they would encounter in the natural world, obviously.
Right.
And also any of these—
I just wanted to say I used morphine as an example there. I don't remember what exactly the compound was they studied, but it's something like that.
Right. Well, it seems like a lot of those studies do use synthetic drug compounds. So it's not mm-hmm. we put a mouse in a small ecosphere with some psychedelic mushrooms and just see how much it would eat. It's something like that.
Right.
It tends to be like a drip of some sort of synthetic version, some artificial substance that's created from a naturally occurring substance.
But yeah, so the question is with these psychedelics, self-administration of psychedelics by animals, why do they do it? Why do they seek hallucinogenic substances? It would seem in many cases to be maladaptive. Now, we do have the one hypothesis already that there are perhaps ways in which some psychedelic compounds could alter brain function in a way that heightens sensory perception.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it helps in hunting by making, by giving you stronger attention to your olfactory senses and makes you better at sniffing out prey. That's a possibility. You know, it's also possible, I've seen some authors speculate, that maybe they consume these substances out of some equivalent to the human experience of boredom. You know, they're seeking novel experiences, which does, that is a drive, the general drive to seek novel experiences is something that has, in some cases, an evolutionary purpose. We've talked on the show before about neophilia, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of, like, animals that seek novel experiences or go toward unfamiliar objects may often, more often put themselves at risk of danger, but they also set themselves up for bigger rewards. So if you're in a you're a raccoon living in a city and you approach an unfamiliar object in a parking lot, it could be full of milkshake, it could be full of fries, but it also could kill you, you know. So it's sort of like a higher stakes way of playing the life game. You know, you get bigger risks, bigger rewards.
Yeah. And of course, another example, just a quick one that to throw out is just the obvious consumption of overripe fruit, mm-hmm. In which fermentation has taken place, and you essentially have naturally occurring alcohol.
Yeah.
Not the synthetic version of this that we have today. You know, anytime you go to, pick up beer or wine or hard liquor or what have you, but the fermented fruit that animals still do eat when they find it.
Well, I don't know. To what extent are that – I mean, those are still made by fermentation, right?
What? You're talking about beer and wine?
Beer and wine. Is there something going on there I don't know about? I thought it was still fermentation was the process by which the alcohol was generated.
Well, yeah, but it's different than the fruit. Like, you know, it is.
That's true. You're not eating the grape.
Right. Like, yeah, there's a – basically we've taken the naturally occurring fermentation process in these fruits and we have harnessed it and we've learned how to concentrate it. So like a bottle of Everclear is a rather different scenario compared to just some fermented fruit that's littered on the ground beneath a tree.
Yeah, and alcohol is clearly a case where animals have often been observed self-administering mm-hmm. a drug. Now, we don't usually think of alcohol as psychedelic. It's not really. But like, you know, elephants will seek out fermented fruits. Some primates will. It's a common thing.
Right.
There's another question is, I guess this is sort of similar to the thing about seeking novel experiences as a certain instinct, especially in maybe mammal brains. I'm sure probably some bird brains too, right? You know. But what if there's some drive in maybe like some mammal brains and some bird brains that seeks altered states of consciousness as a form of what's known in some of the literature as depatterning? There's a tendency toward habit breaking that is made possible by some of these drugs, which I think we'll get into more of the research about that in the next episode.
Oh, yes, we definitely will.
And that's a very important therapeutic use of it. I mean, a lot of the early research on the use of psychedelics in a therapeutic setting was about, say, breaking addictions. Mm-hmm. And that's a form of habit breaking or depatterning of mental processes or mental behaviors. And I wonder if it's possible there is some kind of instinct for that in other animal minds, not just in human brains, a tendency to seek out chemicals that allow you to adapt to new ways of doing things. Could this actually be a drive that's selected for? Again, that's speculative, but it's interesting to consider. But maybe we should get into the history of human use here of these substances.
Yeah, because certainly human use of psychedelics does go back to ancient and prehistoric times. Like that is universally accepted.
Yeah,
The key substances mentioned previously can be found across the continents, and as humans travel, they continually encounter new species as well. I mean, there are parts of the world where there does seem to be more of a concentration of them, mm-hmm. such as Meso and South America. But you do find psychedelic substances all over the place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Michael Pollan in his book, How to Change Your Mind, which mm-hmm. we mentioned in the last episode and is one of our major sources here, which is a fantastic
book.
It is
a wonderful book.
He argues, I'm not sure if he's correct, but he argues that basically pretty much every culture in the world has some kind of tradition of using compounds from natural plants and substances to alter consciousness, with pretty much the only exception being some Arctic peoples,
right?
Because nothing like that grew around there.
Right. But even then, I mean, we have the Siberian use of the fly agaric. So,
yeah.
So, and then the other side of that being like, to what extent did they stick with it? To what extent did they lose the substance? Did the substance fall out of favor? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. You know, some of that we saw with Soma example. But I was reading around about this in the aforementioned sources, but also I picked up a book I often turn to on our other show, Invention, mm-hmm. which is the 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World.
It's a classic.
Yes, it's really good. It's written by Brian M. Fagan, who is just a an authority in ancient technology and ancient invention, and it provides just overviews of various cultural inventions, technological inventions, et cetera. And one of the chapters he writes with Richard Rudgley, who is an author of several books on the history of psychedelic substances and other substances in human culture. Mm-hmm. And they point out that basically, without written reports to go on, with truly ancient people, we tend to have to look for three types of evidence for the consumption of drugs or some sort of psychedelic substance.
Right, because how do we know what they were taking?
Yeah. Right. So we have to look, first of all, for botanical remains associated with burials or agriculture. So, mm-hmm. Do we find the botanical remains of, say, cannabis inside of a tomb or, among the archaeological remains of an agricultural site?
Mm-hmm.
The next thing we look for is artifacts that contain residues. So is there a residue of, say, cannabis in this device? And then clearly, if the device itself looks like it was clearly used for the consumption of drugs, such as a pipe,
right?
Which, some of you might be saying, well, a pipe could be used for just tobacco. Well, bingo, tobacco, also a drug, so that counts.
Right.
And then, of course, artistic motifs that depict mind-altering plants or fungi. That is another big one.
Though I will say a complication there is that very often with the artistic motifs, there's argument about exactly what they represent.
Right.
Like there are people who make the case that there are Stone Age cave paintings that indicate the consumption of psilocybin mushrooms, but I think that's not clear. Not everybody agrees on what's being represented there.
Right. And you get into complex issues with symbolism too. I mean, basically, you could have something that looks like a mushroom in an ancient work, and one side might say, well, that's a mushroom. The other side might say, that is a phallus. And then others might say, well, this could very much be both. And then what does that say that the phallus and the mushroom are combined in the same artistic tradition, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
But for instance, just to put, to drive home some of the periods of time we're talking about here, we know that domesticated opium pops up in the 6th millennium BCE in the Western Mediterranean based on Neolithic burial sites. And then a cannabis pipe cup dates back to the 3rd millennium BCE in Central Asia. And then we have peyote cactus imagery in what is now Mexico and Texas from 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. We also know that the Aztecs used multiple different psychoactive plants for shamanistic purposes, drawing on the long traditional usage of these substances by other peoples of Meso and South America. And then there are, for instance, the statues of the Aztec god Xochipilli that clearly feature the motif of psychoactive plants.
Yeah, Xochipilli is an interesting figure. I was going to say something a bit about him later, but I guess maybe I'll mention it now. We're going to talk a good bit about the use of psilocybin mushrooms in Mesoamerica. But psilocybin mushrooms are not the only psychoactive substances that were used by the Mesoamericans in their religion, such as the Aztecs. Plenty of other plants played a role as well. And this Aztec god, Xochipilli, his name means something like the Prince of Flowers, which is great.
Yeah.
But he's been suggested by several scholars as sort of the embodiment of a number of sacred entheogenic plants known to the Aztecs, including, everything like morning glory and tobacco and a number of flowers and trees that have some degree or another of psychoactive compounds in them.
I'll throw in real quick just to summarize, though. Fagan and Rudgley point out that psychedelic substances are, quote, both deeply embedded in many cultures in prehistoric and ancient Eurasia and intimately bound up with their ceremonial and religious life, and that also likewise in the Americas it was, quote, both prevalent and ancient.
Yeah, I think that's clear. And that's an interesting thing. What, we were talking about the drug war mentality earlier. Mm-hmm. One thing I remember when I was growing up was that there was a clear cultural antagonism between drug use on one hand and religious authority, on the other hand. It seemed like one of the main things, one of the main cultural messages I remember hearing from religious authorities in America, I guess, which would primarily be, you know, Christian authorities, was against the use of drugs, which is at a surface level kind of counterintuitive because on, you know, the use of psychedelic substances goes so far back in religious history with, you know, many of the religions of the world. And because we talked about in the last episode, a very common response to people taking psychoactive substances is not saying like, well, now I'm going to discard my religion and just throw myself fully into secular modernity and become an atheist or something. No, it tends more often to encourage people to think more spiritually, to be more believing in something beyond the material world.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this also reminds me too that, you know, growing up in the with the war of drugs mentality is that when you did learn about religions, modern religions that incorporate some drug, it felt like shocking. Like the first time you heard about the Rastafari faith, you know, you were just like, whoa, they smoke cannabis as part of their faith. You know, that seems shocking. Or you hear about traditional Native American groups that would utilize substances like, say, peyote, and that would seem shocking. And of course, it shouldn't, because again, all these different traditional and ancient religions seem to have been rooted, at least in part, in these substances.
Yeah, I'd say non-drug-based religions are the exception, not the rule, historically.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, I think at a deeper level of analysis, you can kind of see why there's been that conflict between, say, you know, especially a culturally dominant religious authority and the use of psychedelic substances, even though they might encourage general spiritual feelings and beliefs. I think in some cases, the religious condemnation of psychedelic use might be rooted in the anti-heterodoxy sort of impulse, you know, meaning like you don't want people thinking they've received new information from God or the gods. You know,
right.
You don't want people thinking that, like, wait, you know, the dogmas of my church aren't all there is. I'm getting new messages. Things are because then you can't control doctrine. Like a common feature, I guess, of monotheistic religion today is to sort of have a set law and to say, okay, we have received all of the revelations and the rules and the communications from the divine in the past. And now everything's locked down and there will be, you know, the phone lines are cut. There is no further revelation.
Right. If God is still speaking, that can be a dangerous thing to some people, especially, you know, the people that are in a position of power.
Yeah.
But it also seems like the kind of thing that is more of a risk if your religion has drifted away from the sorts of experiences, you know, drug-related or otherwise, that enable that kind of experience.
Yeah.
You know, so we'll get into an example of that, I think, in a bit. But then again, even without, you know, drugs and all, I mean, heresies are always an issue to some sort of established religion. Somebody is going to come along that has a new vision of how this faith should work, how it's going to work with with society, with culture, with the individual, and that is always going to be dangerous to somebody.
Yeah, and I'd say maybe one other reason you can see the religious opposition to drug use is probably just something more rooted in what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, which is like a failure to make crucial distinctions between the effects of these different compounds and how they play out in culture and in people's lives.
Right.
Like, I can understand why if you have a religion that's trying to encourage social orderliness, why it might be against, say, the consumption of alcohol.
Right.
You know, like alcohol is just crime fuel. Alcohol is this like hugely – this substance which, you know, despite it, I enjoy having a beer or a cocktail or something. But you can understand why the temperance movement arose. You know, people were seeing like alcohol is – It's running rampant through the culture, and in some ways it still is.
Yeah, it is a very destructive force. Another issue, of course, is, you know, we talked about previously the description of these substances as being boundary dissolving.
Yeah.
And a lot of times boundaries are very important in an organized religion. The boundary between the in-group and the outsider, the boundaries between particular castes or divisions within a particular religious group. And so, yeah, to the people controlling the religion, the people, you know, in the upper echelon of the religion, boundary dissolution could be dangerous.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. In the same way that you might view alcohol as crime fuel, psychedelics are in some ways heterodoxy fuel or just general questioning and dissolution of established order fuel.
Yeah, the way McKenna put it is, you know, he spends a lot of time talking about cooperative societies and then dominator societies. And, his critique was that alcohol is like the ideal drug of a dominator society. Mm. That and along with stimulants.
Yeah. Well, I think we should take a quick break. And when we come back, we can discuss a little more of the more recent history of psilocybin mushrooms, especially in Mesoamerica.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, we're back. We're looking to Mesoamerica now, which again is a part of the world where you see so many different powerful psychedelic substances. Really, some of the most powerful naturally occurring psychedelic substances on Earth can be found in this part of the world. And of course, this is also part of the world with a very complex and bloody history, and where we see this prime clashing of cultures as Western colonialism enters the picture.
Yeah, exactly right. So the mycologist Paul Stamets, we were talking about how far back the use of psychedelic substances goes. In his book, Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World, Stamets argues that the sacramental use of psychoactive mushrooms goes back at least 7,000 years, probably extends into Paleolithic times. We don't know exactly for sure. But one of the most well-documented religious uses of psychedelic mushrooms is the apparently long-running use in Mexico and Central America of a species of psilocybe, now believed to be Psilocybe mexicana, that was then known to the Aztecs as Teonanacatl, which was historically translated as God's flesh, but I've also seen translated, I think more recently and simply as the god mushroom. So there might be some blurring of the line there, whether a word means flesh or mushroom, there might be some overlap there. But we don't know exactly how far back the use of psilocybes among the Mesoamericans goes. Earlier, you mentioned, you know, the art motifs is one clue. And there are archaeological artifacts found in Central America, I think primarily in Guatemala, now known as the Mushroom Stones. And these are attributed to the Mayan civilization. They depict humans, animals, and gods as sort of hybrid mushroom beings with mushroom stems and caps erupting up out of their bodies, kind of like the Lohenmensch, you know, the Lion Man statuette. From Europe, showing the humanoid figure with the lion's head, showing early ideation about monsters and fantasy hybrids, except this would be like the fungus minch.
Oh, wow. This is like in Dungeons & Dragons, this would be the Myconids, which are the mushroom people of the Underdark.
Oh, what's that movie you were telling me about a long time ago? It was like
Matango.
Matango, yeah, the Mushroom Island.
Japanese horror film about these humanoid mushrooms and this infection that turns people into mushrooms, shambling mushroom creatures.
Oh, yeah. There are also, that's a central conceit of the setting of the video game The Last of Us, which—
Cordyceps,
yeah, invades humans. But anyway, this is a slightly different thing because it's not showing like fungus erupting as a disease out of people, but more like there are these fungus beings that seem, I don't know, they're generally depicted as kind of like serene and like this is a good thing. We don't know exactly what these ancient mushroom stones signify, but many scholars have interpreted them as reflections of the religious significance of psychedelic mushrooms for the Mayan culture. And so much of the world became aware of the existence and use of psychedelic mushrooms during the 1950s due to the work of people like the biologist Richard E. Schultes, who studied indigenous peoples' uses of psychoactive plants, especially in Mexico and in the Amazon basin. And public widespread awareness of the uses of psychedelic mushrooms in southern Mexico, specifically Teonanacatl, owes a lot to an article published in Life magazine in May 1957, written by a then vice president of J.P. Morgan, the investment bank and financial services company. This vice president of J.P. Morgan was named R. Gordon Wasson, who was also a mycologist. He and his wife were both very interested in mushrooms. And he happened to be a mushroom enthusiast. I think he was pushing a kind of personal theory that mushrooms were the genesis of all religions and spiritual beliefs. But this article from Life magazine in 1957 was called "The Discovery of Mushrooms That Cause Strange Visions," and then also with the title "Seeking the Magic Mushroom." I think one was the cover title and one was on the article. But I want to stress again that despite the magazine editor's word choice there of the discovery of mushrooms that cause strange visions, Wasson did not in any way actually discover psilocybin mushrooms. They were known to the indigenous peoples of Mexico and Central America for hundreds or thousands of years. They just weren't widely known about in many other cultures in the 20th century beyond that.
Now, I think it is important to note, too, that people like Wasson and Schultes, these were a different breed of professional. So much of the time when we think about the emergence of psychedelics, we think of Timothy Leary. Or even, you know, we think in more in like a 90s context, we think of Terrence McKenna. People were more, you know, embodiments of counterculture. And that is not what these individuals were about. In fact, I believe it was Wasson who really did not like what he saw in the counterculture. You know, he was kind of anti-hippie.
Oh, I don't know, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Weren't you saying something about McKenna talking about Schultes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He pointed out that Schultes was pretty much the complete opposite of someone like Timothy Leary. He was a botanist and a scientist. And he was at Harvard at the same time while Leary was approaching psychedelics from a social science perspective, but also with arguably far less dedication to the rigors of scientific investigation and with a strong inclination towards celebrity and the trappings of guru.
Yeah.
But Schultes was also highly influential on a whole range of people, including E.O. Wilson, but also people like William Burroughs.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, again, the impact of their work is essential when you consider like all strains of knowledge and interest in psychedelic substances.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one question you might have is like, if there were peoples of especially like southern Mexico and Oaxaca who were practicing the religious use of psilocybin mushrooms, this question of, like, why didn't more people outside of the region know about this? And I think there's a very good reason, actually, why some of the indigenous peoples of southern Mexico would keep these mushrooms and their uses a secret as a sort of underground parallel ritual to the Catholicism that took hold of the region beginning in the 16th century. And that reason was psychedelic mushrooms and their religious uses had been brutally persecuted hundreds of years before by the Christian conquistadors in what the ethnobotanist Jonathan Ott has called the Pharmocratic Inquisition. Basically, when the Spanish attacked and began to colonize Mexico and Central America under Cortez in the early 16th century, the Catholic missionaries among them became aware that some parts of Aztec religion relied on the consumption of fungi that allowed the Aztecs to actually see and receive guidance from their gods. And so these ritual feasts of the Tiahuanacatl would sometimes be used for the purposes of divination, where you'd try to, like, receive guidance from the gods, or for other purposes like ritual healing. And the mushroom rites were witnessed and described by a Spanish Franciscan friar named Bernardino de Sahagún. This is a section of de Sahagún's work that is also quoted in Pollan. Quote, "These they ate before dawn with honey, and they also drank cacao before dawn. The mushrooms they ate with honey, and when they began to get heated from them, they began to dance, and some sang, and some wept. Some cared not to sing, but would sit down in their rooms and stayed there, pensive-like. And some saw in a vision that they were dying, and they wept. And others saw in a vision that some wild beast was eating them. Others saw in a vision that they were taking captives in war. Others saw in a vision that they were to commit adultery and that their heads were to be bashed in, therefore. Then, when the drunkenness of the mushrooms had passed, they spoke one with another about their visions that they had seen."
Oh, wow. I also love the mention of the honey, because I think there's sort of two avenues here. Like, one is that, of course, many of these psychedelic substances, especially the mushrooms, are quite pungent in their taste, and there's something, you know, you need to mask it in some way or another.
Yeah.
But also I've read how honey could have been used traditionally to preserve psychedelic substances, particularly mushrooms.
Yeah.
And that even there's this idea that certain mead traditions arose out of that. Which, of course, is the fermentation process with the honey to produce an alcohol beverage.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had not heard that. But you might expect what the Catholic reaction to this is. In fact, I bet some of this reaction is coming through even in the way that Bernardino de Sahagún describes these experiences, because you notice he tends to emphasize what he thinks are these, like, negative hallucinogenic experiences, mm-hmm. about war and about death and about being eaten by an animal. The Catholic missionaries viewed the Aztec consumption of this and other psychedelic plants as a form of depraved pagan idolatry that needed to be wiped from the face of the earth.
It's basically the same anti-psychedelic messaging that you saw in the 60s, right? Saying, like, the kids are taking this and they're having bad trips and they're forcing themselves through keyholes.
They're picking up the axe and going after, you know, the grandparents.
Right. They're confusing a baby with a basketball and raising the basketball as their own and, and creating a college fund for the basketball. Clearly, this has to be stopped.
Yeah. It's exactly right. So, yeah, the Catholic missionaries wrote that they believe the consumption of Tiahuanacatl was a way for the Aztecs to receive messages from the devil and from demons. And, of course, it must have seemed especially perverse to the missionary mindset that at the time, the Aztec priests would have been understood to be eating this thing called God's flesh, given the parallels to the Catholic rite of Holy Communion, in which you would eat bread and drink wine representing the flesh and the blood of Jesus Christ. So the Catholic missionaries tried to put down the ceremonies of the psilocybes, and they encouraged the substitution of what Jonathan Ott referred to, seemingly by contrast, as the placebo sacraments of the Catholic Eucharist. Hmm. But fortunately, despite the persecution by the Catholic colonizers, these mushroom rituals did continue in secret through to the modern day, especially in more remote and mountainous regions, like in southern Mexico and Oaxaca.
Now, questions of how they used these substances were used as a fascinating subject unto itself, and one where, you know, not going to have time to fully examine. I mean, whole books have been written describing this. Basically the idea is that set and setting would again be of primary importance here.
Yeah, we talked about that in the last episode, but the importance of the surroundings and the mindset going in.
Right. And then some of the more fascinating examples that we see in the Amazon, you know, where ayahuasca is brewed from the yagé vine, et cetera. But, you know, they also turn to other substances as well. And they also turn to dreams in the shamanistic practice, which I think is interesting as well. Like, it's not like these substances were the only tool that was utilized. They would also refer to dreams. And then in terms of the shamanistic use of the substances themselves, you might think that such practices would simply involve a shaman giving you a substance, guiding you through the experience to help you with your problem. And this is true. This is what you would see. And you see this reflected in the Western, some of the Western research that we'll be discussing later. You see it in some of the counterculture and underground uses of it. But in the classic scenarios, the shaman was sometimes the one to ingest the substance alone and solve your problem for you, which seems kind of counterproductive or counterintuitive at first, right? The idea that you would go to the shaman and the shaman would take a psychedelic in order to help you with your problem, and you wouldn't take anything. But this could well be the case in some of these situations. You know, the shaman would step outside of their own self in order to tackle your problem head on and help you solve it.
Yeah, exactly. So to finish the story, in the 1950s, this J.P. Morgan banker we mentioned, right, R. Gordon Wasson, he traveled to Oaxaca in Mexico, and he met with an experienced psilocybe shaman known as a curandera, or which meant like a healer, named Maria Sabina, who allowed him to participate in a psilocybin healing and divination ritual known as a velada to the Mazatec people. And Wasson wrote about this experience in that Life magazine article we mentioned in 1957, and subsequently scientific interest in the mushroom skyrocketed. People eventually sent samples of the fruiting bodies of the mushrooms to Albert Hofmann, the man who first isolated LSD-25 from ergot rye and discovered its effects the decade before. And Hofmann and colleagues were able to isolate the psychoactive compounds in the mushroom, and, of course, Hofmann had to try some out himself. And for a while before the anti-counterculture backlash and the drug war crackdown, psilocybin was researched by psychologists, psychiatrists, as a potential tool for understanding human cognition, expanding consciousness, and treating addiction and mental illness. But, of course, then came the dark days, right, beginning in the 1970s, where the association of psilocybin with hippie culture and recreational drug use created this stigma around research. Legal barriers went up that made research more practically difficult, and a lot of mainstream research attention just turned away from psilocybin in particular and psychedelics in general. And I guess that's where we'll have to stop for this time until we come back next time.
Yeah, so the journey continues. The trip is not over. It will continue in episode 3. Of this journey. So in the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, check out past episodes that have dealt with psychedelics, such as the Timothy Leary episode, the John C. Lilly episodes, or some of these other episodes we've alluded to, you'll find them there. That's the mothership, stufftoblowyourmind.com. And if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do is to tell your friends about us and also rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. So I don't know how you listen to your podcasts. Maybe if you find them carved into a piece of wood. You probably get them through some sort of service online or on your phone. Wherever it is, leave us some stars, leave a nice review. It really helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our audio producer, Maya Cole. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback about this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.